Hi, I'm Jen.
And I'm Jen.
Welcome to Marginalia Pod,
where we treat reading as a sacred practice and find meaning and connections through our favorite book.
I would like to begin by acknowledging the Gurungay and Daru people, traditional custodians of the land where I am recording today, and pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging.
I'd also like to acknowledge Mana Whenua of Te Awa Kairangi Ki Tai, where I'm recording today.
Hello, lovely Jen.
Hi, how are you? Did you have a stressful evening last night?
It was probably the most stressful I have ever felt, except for the rugby finals last year, which I was also similarly stressed at. It felt like the stakes were really high yesterday, and it felt like the stakes were really high at the rugby finals last year.
Yeah.
Or was that this year? When was that?
That was last year.
Okay, yeah. But oh my gosh, how about you? Were you just lying there, like, freaking out, like what the rest of us were? Penalties.
Yeah, I mean, it was very stressful, but that's the best bit of soccer, is the penalties. So I'm like, this should just be the whole game. Why is this not the whole game? Why is this thing tacked on at the end? Doesn't make sense.
You're literally the only person who thinks that penalties are better than gameplay. Everybody else was like, we were running out of the
room. At least something is happening. I would prefer it.
Oh, there was a lot happening, and there's definitely a lot I want to say about the French team and their antics. I had a lot of discussions about whether it's purely a European style of playing to just fall down and cry every time you get grazed by another player, because I don't see that here. That doesn't happen with the Australian team. It doesn't happen with the New Zealand team. So we'll have to see how we go on the match Wednesday, but who knew I could care so much about sports ball?
It's been great seeing everyone get really into it, though. It's really lovely.
It has, and the Matildas have broken all sorts of records about viewership and streaming, and this was the most penalties ever scored in a World Cup ever, for men or women. Like, it was an intensely insane 3 hours. I couldn't believe that they were still that fighting so strong after 3 hours. I can't do that after I've been awake for 3 hours, much less running around on a pitch for 3 hours. Good grief.
Yeah. Oh, dear. So, is that what sparked joy for you this week then? The finale, well, quarterfinal, not even final.
Quarterfinal, yeah. It felt momentous. It definitely sparked joy. It sparked joy to know that there was like a whole community of people. I don't think I know a single person who didn't watch the game. So it really did feel like something that was like a unifying thing for everyone that I know personally. Just like Instagram was just full of Matildas. Tumblr was full of Matildas even. It was great. So that definitely sparked joy. But the other thing that sparked joy for me was that I went running, and I was like, I have not been running regularly, so I ran 3 times last week, and I'm exhausted.
But amazing.
Thank you.
Nice.
Ooh, well, the first 2Ks of every run was just torture, but after that it was fine. How about you? What sparked joy for you this week?
I had a terrible week, I'm not going to lie. So the joy was thin on the ground, but we did go and have a visit with the kittens. So my housemate is adopting 2 kittens and we went to see them. They're still getting up to weight. So once they're the right weight, they'll be able to come home with us, which we're expecting not next weekend, but the weekend after, all things going well. So yeah, we're adding 2 kittens to the family.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, they're very cute and very cuddly.
I love how excited and inquisitive kittens are. Yeah, I just love their little naughtiness and cheekiness so much. I wouldn't do it again, but yeah. I enjoyed it with our accidental kitten. He was pretty great.
Yeah, so we'll see how our existing matron goes with it, but hopefully they're all friends and we can have a calm time.
Well, ours is 10 months into being a co-cat and she is still not impressed at all, so fingers crossed Luna's a little more flexible.
We'll see. I doubt it, but we'll see.
Oh, well. As long as she has a place that's her own, she'll be fine.
Yeah, that's the plan anyway. Okay, well, this week we're reading chapters 29 through 37 through the theme of envy. Did you have a story in the theme of envy?
So I want to talk about envy. First, I need to define it. Like, I want to be able to parse it a little bit down. I know that a lot of people conflate envy and jealousy, but they're very different. So in my view, and this is sort of as I've grown up understanding them both and sort of what the dictionary says, envy is distinct from jealousy jealousy is like the fear of losing something that we could have or do have, and envy is coveting what we don't have and might never have. So it's like a difference of like a fear of loss versus a wanting of something. And so envy to me has always been about wanting what is impossible, or but it's something that other people could have, but it's something that I never could. And I've definitely wanted things that were impossible for me to have. And I think this mostly relates to just being neurodivergent in a world that didn't understand neurodivergence nearly as well as it does now. So I can trace this right back to childhood. The first memory that I have that really pointed out how different I was that I had a scout leader who told a scary story about a girl who talked too much and had her fingernails pulled off one by one. And at the time I knew that this was directed at me, like I was seven, but I was aware that this was a story for me. This was a lesson for me that I was a chatterbox. And I also remember at the time being like, oh, not my scout leader too. Like, you know, I was already aware of this happening. I knew that it was something that I had to expect, but I was like disappointed in this adult for all like falling into the trap of everyone else. And that was also the first time that I really started to think, maybe it is me that's the problem. Maybe if I weren't a chatterbox, then I wouldn't have these adults treating me the way that they do. You know, telling me that I was annoying or bad or too much or not enough or just not who I was supposed to be. So I began to look at other people and see what they were like. And I started to envy people who were the right amount all of the time. I think that kind of envy wasn't great for me. It turned me into a chameleon, but like a chameleon, the changes only ever went skin deep, right? So I could put on normal person mask, but then if the mask came off, it would come off in such a dramatic way that everyone around me would be bewildered and shell-shocked. Oh, she's not who I thought she was. When actually not having the mask and being genuinely upset about something or being genuinely emotional about something was how I was living all of the time. But people, you know, they were disappointed because I wasn't who I had presented myself to be. So that was something I did a lot, especially as I became a teenager and a young adult, and especially as I was living on my own. I just had these masks, so many masks. Then as I got older, I began to envy people who were campfires on their own. You know, the kind of people who, like, goodness seems to just shine out of them and they really warm others up. And I wanted so badly to be like that. I mean, how do you channel envying someone whose personality is a draw to others? How do you turn that into something worthwhile? I don't think I ever could, though. I've always been so angry at the world for being unjust. I can't be complacent. I can't ignore the slights of the world. I can only ever be an inferno. Like, I am a forest fire. I am not a lovely little campfire. But I still tried. I tried to turn that envy into something like a motivator. I tried to starve my inner fire to be more palatable to others. But that came with the realization that politeness and surface kindness, they don't actually change the world. They don't do anything. They just make people feel comfortable. And there's a time and a place for that. But like for the things that I really care about and I'm really passionate about, I kind of need to let myself rage. And it is the anger that I have that makes me want to be kind. It was the envy of other people being loved that made me want to be more palatable. It made me want to be perceived as kind, but it wasn't actually leading me to being kind. So I had to root envy out of myself, example by example. I had to really assess everything that I valued. I had to decide what I wanted and what I wanted to do and who I wanted to be. And I had to stop trying to file away my own edges in order to become somebody that I wasn't. And I will say that this takes time and space, and you need to have compassionate companions. It's not something you can just flip a switch on and stop envying people. You have to be willing to go through all of this hard work. But I've worked really hard at it, and now there's not a lot of room for envy because I had to prize acceptance over everything else. And once you have acceptance, then envy doesn't really get its hooks in. Sometimes I still have a little wistful what if that could bloom into a truly envious feeling, but it's a lot easier to say, oh, hey, that's just a thought. And it's not me. I have thoughts, but I am not my thoughts. So yeah, I think envy was a tool for me to learn how to be in the world, but it didn't actually serve me in the end.
What a great reframing of envy as a tool that you can use to get you somewhere rather than something that holds you back. You know, like it's a lovely place to get to.
Yeah, there was a lot of envy and ambition seem to go really similar. Like, can you use it to spur yourself on? And I always say that I'm not ambitious, but like I do desperately want to be liked. So I think that if I had an ambition, it would be to be well-liked. Like, that would be the ambition that I would admit to. And letting go of that was really hard. Or accepting that it wasn't going to be a universal thing was really hard.
Yeah. Well, I'm proud of you. Good work.
Thanks. And to wherever my scout leader is, I hope that she learned and grew from that, because she was truly awful to a 7-year-old who did not mean anyone any harm.
Yeah, that's unhelpful. Unhelpful adulting.
Oh, God, if anyone had said that to my kids, I would have, like, murdered them on the spot. Just so different the way that things were in the 90s.
Honestly, it's amazing that we came out of it with, you know, some yeah. sense intact.
Oh, 100%. Would you like to read our chapter summaries for us this week?
Sure, thanks. So this week, Baz and Simon decide to attend one of those Chosen One rallies they've heard about. Baz finds it all a bit too vague and unsatisfying, but can't quite convince Daphne to come back home. Daphne is convinced she would be better off staying with Smith Richards rather than going home to her family. Ouch. Meanwhile, Penelope and Shep have visited an ogre's bar, been served drinks by an ent, and are on their way to a magical forger for help, who reveals inadvertently that Shep is engaged to said demon. Neve and Agatha have it out over goats and magic and gossip. So, a lot going on in this section.
So much. Shep didn't want Penny to find out that he wasn't technically single, which cracks me up. Like, I feel like that is the least of your problems, Shep.
Yeah, poor Penny, right? Like, she just never feels like she has all the information at the moment. She just can't catch a break.
Yeah, and that's something she really needs to feel in control of her environment, as she needs all of the information. Yeah, 100%.
Mm. I'm glad you mentioned the difference between envy and jealousy in your story, because I think there is a lot of jealousy in this section, but envy, I think, is harder to get through and is a bit more subjective in some ways, which is quite interesting. And I think the clearest envy is just this depth of magic that you have in this universe, where there are people who don't have magic who are envious of people who do and whose lives are so easy, right? Because they have this untapped reservoir that they will never have.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing with Smith Richards, it's like every self-help guy, every fad diet guy, everybody who is selling a concept for betterment that actually relies on the people having to change their fundamental selves. Just something about it just sets my teeth on edge. He doesn't seem like, because he's not doing it for them. He really isn't. He's doing it for himself. We get this little tiny chapter where he's like, the old chosen one is coming to me, the chosen one. Like, he's excited because it's landing. Things are landing for him. He's not excited because he gets an opportunity to help someone who did this wonderful thing for the magical community, right? It's like he envies Simon's fame, but he's found a different path to get his own fame.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just like, I think in a way it just really plays upon the power structures of the world. You know, this social structure that has enabled this kind of charlatanism to take root, because you've created a system of haves and have nots, right? And it's something so fundamental, you know, and it's the expectations people have of themselves as well. Like Baz says on page 236, I even recognize a few other people in the crowd, people I'd never have thought of as weak musicians. Because they're not weak magicians, but they exist in this society where they have these expectations that they should have more and they should be better. So they also get sucked into this thing because I can be more powerful.
I think it's interesting how Daphne is so inspired by this guy. She wants to be a better mage than she is. And it's something that she's been carrying around all this time. And she has felt this enormous shame about it. And I think that her envy of the more capable mages is really what has driven her to leave her kids, who she obviously loves. Like, she's making a huge sacrifice for them to leave them for this amount of time. Like, Swithin's still a baby. This is hard for her. But she's really convinced that it will help her to be a better mage. Like, this is something she's really passionate about because she wants it. And I wonder if how much of the envy of people who have this power is just quietly hidden and tucked away, and then you get this guy who takes advantage of it. There's something in that, like preying on people's insecurities, yes, but also preying on their secret ambitions or secret hopes.
Yeah, it's that kind of vulnerability that people have for fame or for richness, right? That allows scammers to come in and take everything they have, because everyone has this like little kernel in them where they think, oh, you know, if only that was me, if only it was easier, you know?
Yeah, if I looked a certain way, if I made this amount of money.
I love that Baz says to her, you know, you've got a great life, and then he calls himself out on it, where he's like, oh, that's not really for me to say. But yeah, this expectation that he had of her, right? Like, he's like, oh, she's fine with having that magic. She doesn't even care. But she does care. Yeah. Like, all these people care because they live in a society that makes them care, and they can pretend not to, but they're still working within an existing power structure.
Even Penelope's dad is there. And this is like just a little mention that Simon sees him in the back of the crowd with his head down, hurrying out. Like, he knows that Simon is there and he doesn't want to be seen by him. But he is there looking at this chosen one, hoping, you know?
Yeah.
It's a lot. It's a lot to realize. And I think for the people who have a lot of magic and they just assume that it's fine because they have a lot, it's very much like privilege, you know? Like, I know a lot of straight-sized people who don't really understand how hard it is to be big, and then they're like, what do you mean you can't fit into the clothes at the shops? And, you know, you have to explain to them, like, okay, well, that doesn't actually fit everybody, and it doesn't even fit most of everybody. Like, you are very lucky that you can walk into a shop and buy what you want. Oh, but can't you? Well, not everything, actually. And, like, this is the same thing. It's a privilege thing. There's magical privilege, and, you know, Baz has it. And I think this is a good opportunity for him to really look at what's going on in the world around him, him and Penny both, and say, oh, right, there's this entire group of people who don't have this. And we have made them feel bad about it. But because they've never had to examine that, like, Simon is their only lens for that. And he had more than anyone, and now he has none. They just ignore it rather than dealing with it or treating it as something to really sort of focus in on.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that there's always called on as an outside standard that has been set. Like, you know, Daphne says on page 237, you know, Basil, you don't understand. You've always been powerful. You've always lived up to your parents' standards, to the world standards. And then on page 255, Lady Ruth says, it's what Jamie's always wanted. It's what we expected for him once upon a time. And I think that for is so interesting, not of him, for him, because the world has set this limit, especially for Jamie, you know, who had to clear a certain bar to even get into Watford, right? Yeah. That he didn't ultimately make. So there's this external pressure to perform a certain way. And if you don't, it affects your life, like it hampers your opportunities.
Absolutely. This series gives us so much to work with in terms of really analyzing out the kind of magic that everyone has or doesn't have. But the interesting thing I keep coming back to is that Simon Snow obviously has a learning disability, and we've learned now, or we will learn throughout this book, that's an inherited learning disability. And it just really makes me think, no matter how many prophecies you enact or force to happen, you still end up with child, and that child will have whatever traits they have. It's just an interesting tangent, I think. I keep turning this over in my mind that Simon's magic couldn't work the way other people's magic worked because he was never that good with words. We only see him becoming good with words now that he and Baz have gotten to a point where their communication is open enough that he can wait Simon out till the words come, which is so amazing. And that happened several times in this section. I have heart eyes for the two of them so much right now.
And no, the communication's great. And it's like the expectations that's being subverted as well. I just really love that. Like, I think, you know, they both had expectations previously of what a relationship would be, and that stunted their communication. And now that they've let go of that, they can move forward. And like, it's so great when you see people challenging and changing in that way. You know how Baz says on page 223, first, I don't know what's coming, and then I don't know what's hit me. And I can't believe how much better it is bracing for something instead of more nothing. Like, he's just like, yeah, I much prefer this whiplash rather than just never knowing anything that's going on. And I love it for them. I just love it so much.
Yes. Oh, so good. I really like that Simon, at the end of the section that we read, was kind of like, is this too much? I want to be around you all the time. I want to be with you all the time. Is that not okay? Will you tell me if it's too much? And Baz is like, it's not too much. And he's like, as if I would ever get tired of you. It's like his internal monologue and his external output is actually kind of syncing up now finally. But I love that Simon was allowing himself to like use his words and be vulnerable. And then Baz realized, oh, he needs me to say something. And he's like, it's not too much. He actually said it. And I was like, you guys, you're doing it. I am so proud of you.
And similarly with the whole Vegas conversation, right? At first, Baz is kind of like dismissive of it. And then he's like, oh, no, Simon actually needs me to say it. And he's like, I'll keep saying it as much as you need to hear it. And it is so important that he does that, because I think Simon did really need to hear what Baz was saying. He really needed to internalize that. So for them to have that conversation is just so great.
Yeah. And I think Simon does envy other people who are attracted to Baz, because he kind of feels like he's just this lumpy mess who's not worth anything. Yeah. Like, he doesn't feel like he's attractive. Everybody looks at Baz and sees how handsome he is. He sees how handsome Baz is. He sees how handsome everybody is. Like, Baz only has eyes for Simon, but Simon has eyes, period. Like, he looks at everyone. He sees how attractive people are and comments on it. Like, that's part of his monologue, internal monologue. So I think it's really interesting that he compares himself to all of these people who Baz might find more attractive. And I think he just finds himself falling short. He doesn't want to do anything about it, or he doesn't know if he should or can, but he definitely feels it, which I feel like is a bit of envy, right?
Yeah, like wanting to be as poised or as together or just better at things than what you necessarily are. Yeah.
Yeah, which is why Lady Ruth is so good, because she just feeds them and likes them. It's just so good.
I think there's a bit of envy on the part of both Neve and Agatha. Mm. I think they're kind of envious of each other's obliviousness. Like, yeah. I think Agatha is sort of enthralled by the fact that Neve did not care about what she was up to at school, did not know anything that was going on, was just vibing. And then I think Neve, even though she's frustrated by it, I think she's sort of envious of the fact that Agatha just goes through life just...
in Agatha land.
With blinkers on to... Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's this weird kind of, there's kind of like that popular girl envy, you know, when you see a popular girl and you're like, I get that vibe from Neve because she's so mean.
She is so mean, but I think it's also the jealousy of like the friend group that Agatha was perceived to have. And there was a lot of like to do about it. And I can understand that being like, oh, not these guys again, when they're literally ruining your school career. Like, that's fair. I feel like that's something you can be grumpy about. But the way that she presents it is if, like, Agatha's content with the world revolving around her. And Agatha's said so many times, like, I do not care about that. And I don't want to deal with it. Like, it was annoying to be repeatedly kidnapped. But I love that they're both, like, Agatha really wants to understand why Neve cares about stuff, but she's really grumpy that she wants to understand why Neve cares about stuff. Makes my heart so happy. I'm like, your gay is showing, Agatha.
I love that we see the expectation of knowledge with both of them as well. Like, you go through life sometimes just expecting people know what you know, and then you're confronted with the fact that this person has never heard of this. Yeah. So, like, Neve doesn't know that Agatha and Simon broke up, and
like a year ago.
Neve wants everyone to know about the goats, and she just assumes people know about the goats, and she's like, why doesn't everyone know about this? Yeah, it's interesting.
I love
moments like that in real life.
yeah you're absolutely right. It's nice when you connect with someone and you're like, wait, tell me about this thing that I know nothing about. Like, what have I missed? I just love learning, so I think that that's really fun when you can get someone who's willing to explain it to you. But I do think that they're frustrated with each other, and I like the idea that it's because they envy each other's ability to, like, step outside of their own experience. On page 233, where Smith Richards is saying, let's not make you wait anymore. Let's give you the life you've deserved all along. This is a really pernicious myth that, like, you deserve more than you have. And in terms of the magical, like, I think it's just kind of like you get what you get. Like, if you're 5'5 and you wish you were 5'10, it's not that you don't deserve to be 5'10, right? I really struggle with that. But I think that that's a way of him using envy as a tool to get people into his, like, cult.
Yeah, that's what cults do, right? And that's how they get money from people.
Which is what he's doing. He's fleecing these people.
Yeah, always making people want something else and make them believe that they can have it. I would argue this is also how right-wing politics work.
Yes, but... yeah, a lot of the time, for sure.
It's kind of also like, you know, like you were saying before, self-help books, like The Secret, right? If you just manifest it, it will come true because you deserve it.
I just want to shout out to one of my favorite debunking podcasts, which is called Books That Kill. And they just take, they take a self-help book, but sort of the, like, business or popular science ones, and they actually do, like, the weeks of research that a normal person doesn't have time to do. And they talk about each point and they, like, debunk these books. And it's very sweary, but it is really good, especially if you've thought, like, oh, I need to read this book about how to be better at business or how to do this or whatever. Like, they just do it for you. And then they tell you in a few words what's good about it, what's actually nonsense. And a lot of it's nonsense.
The thing I hate about books like that, and I know some people just love them, but I always think that they are too long. Like, for me, you read the introduction and you get exactly where they're going. And then I'm like, why is there 20 chapters of this? I don't need to read this whole book. Like, you're saying the same thing over and over again.
Yep. You would love this podcast because they complain about this exact same thing every time. They're like, please do not read this 600-page book. It should have been an article. Like,
yeah, always. Been. Every time. Yes. I'm like, why are you saying this again?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, yeah. But a lot of those prey on envy as well. So, I mean...
Yeah, oh, yeah, totally. It's, the things that you can't have, but that you want, right? It's not envy, but it's expectation. I just think it's so interesting that, you know, the world of mages has this expectation of a chosen one.
Yeah.
But then Simon also has expectations of a chosen one because he had those expectations of himself, what it meant to be a chosen one. And then when he claps eyes on Smith Richard, he's just like, what, him? I didn't expect this guy. He's like, you know, someone more intimidating or someone more obviously shamming, maybe even twirling a moustache. Not a hot guy in jeans. And then Baz makes the comparison that Smith just looks like Simon, but like the Netflix movie version.
Like he would be cast on the I was just going to say that. I love that he's like, he says that and then he says, no, thank you. Because Baz is fully convinced that like Simon was the chosen one and did the thing. And like, I mean, he even says it like one, yeah. You repaired the magical firmament. Mm. And like what he puts this to Daphne, like, okay, what is this guy really fixing? And she's like, what if we're the thing that has been the greatest threat to magic all along? And I was like, oh God, barf. Okay. But yeah, I mean, I can see why this would suck someone in, right? Like, what if I'm my own problem? It's very new agey. It's very therapy speak. I can see why it works, but it makes me mad.
It is, yeah, maddening. It just cracks me up that Simon, he has such warped perception of himself that Baz is like, yeah, he looks like Simon. And Simon's like, oh, hot. This hot young guy with his curly hair, his curly bronze hair. Like, Simon, the call's coming from inside the house. Like,
I know, he can't think of himself honestly. As anything but, like, lumpy and unattractive. And, like, I mean, to be fair, Baz did specify in the first book that he's actually very unremarkable. He was like, he's not even that good looking, but I can't help but think he's very attractive and I love him. I like that he's average. I think it's good that he's average. More average looking heroes, thank you.
Speaking of that, it cracks me up that Neve is just like oblivious to Baz's hotness. Like, everyone talks about how hot Baz is and Neve's like, what, the pale guy mm-hmm. with the crooked nose? And Agatha's like, literally never heard him described like that, but okay. He's so gay.
I love, yeah, she's the most lesbian of all lesbians.
Do you think that Penny is envious of Shep's easy way of going through life?
Yes.
Like, easy way of making friends, easy way of just finding things.
I think she is, but I think she's couching it in that real grumpiness. She's doing the same thing that Agatha's doing with Neve, where Agatha's like, oh, this person is so strong featured and why is their hair so soft looking? And Penny's like, oh, this guy's so nice and friendly. This should have taken me weeks of research. Like, she's just grumpy about it working out for this person that she actually has quite a crush on, I think, would be my read on that.
Yeah.
And I do think she has some envy because she keeps talking about how, like, he's just found these things and gotten in and he's so smug about it, but he's not actually smug about it, and it would be better if he was smug about it. Like, she's just having a time. So yeah.
And I feel like her expectations of the magical world is just continually being challenged. Like, she goes to this bar, she's like, it's just in plain sight. And then she opens the door and she's like, is that an ant? Yeah. Are ants real?
That was my favorite part for you. I was like, ants. Also, I love that Shep just bought him a drink. He's legal in the UK. He could have alcohol, but he doesn't. Bless him.
I also just love that the end guy is like, I can't just point to the back of the pub where we keep our wizened old keeper of the sacred texts. Like, just this expectation. It's not national treasure. It's not the Da Vinci Code.
I think maybe our tree barkeep likes to watch movies in his spare time. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. And you know what I love? Like, I love that Penny complains about Shep, but I think you're right in that she really relies on him to be the way that he is. Like, she has expectations of his behavior because she says, you know, on page 248, I'm waiting for Shepard to ask impertinent questions that will shed more light on the subject. She's like, he will do the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's why she's so mad that he's lied to her, because she's like, I thought you were one thing and now yet again, I was wrong.
Yes, she didn't want to be proved right in this way, which is an interesting take, right? And that's something she hasn't gotten around to interrogating yet, but she's mad that she was proved right.
Yeah.
I kind of want to get your opinion on this. This really struck me as being like a hard thing to think about. But on page 209, Shep and Penny are having a conversation and they're saying, you know, so magicians make friends with normals all the time and tell them about being magicians. Never. And then Penny's like reflecting on how that was one of the things she thought was really good about her and Micah, was that they could talk about magic and do magic together and practice their spell work, and they were going to have a magical life together. And then she wonders about his girlfriend who's normal, and is he going to be honest with her about that? And I was thinking, like, it's hard. It must be really hard that you can never really be who you truly are. Like, you have this whole other secret existence. Like, how do people reconcile
that? Yeah. I think this is more of a Pennyism. Like, this is something she's internalized from her mum that we never tell normals, because we know that the American magical community is very different, and I think they actually would tell. I think Micah would tell her if she was, you know, open-minded to it. Like, I don't think this is something that he'd necessarily hide. Like, Penny assumes that everyone would keep it secret. I just don't think that is what's happening.
Yeah, it feels too, like, conspiracy theory to believe that that is true.
Yeah.
But I can also see why, like, if you've been told your whole life that you can't tell anybody this thing, why would you?
But I don't think other people have been told that their whole lives. That's what I mean. I don't think that is the case in the American system at all.
It's an interesting thing that magic could fall by the wayside, too. I mean, what if you didn't have magical kids? You would just give it up?
Let it go. You might also just choose not to pursue it, right? You might just not be, like Agatha wanted to.
Yeah.
You might just be like, this isn't for me.
You know, people who are tall being told that they should play basketball. Like, you don't have to. It's okay. It's really fine if you don't.
I really love on that same section, page 208, when Penny says, we don't need magical coffee houses. We're magical wherever we go. Like, I love this idea that, you know, Shep is looking for markers, and Penny is sort of saying, well, we're always magical. We don't need these special places.
Yes, and the ones that are the magical places are run by the people who are outcast from the mages. Like, you'll find more and varied magic in the places that aren't run by mages, because they've had to sort of, I don't know, band together to be, like...
Yeah, and carve out their own
place. Yeah, they had to form their own connections, because they've been basically treated like garbage from... By the mages. It's a really interesting thing. I love that Penny's getting a real reckoning here. I love that she's having to rely on somebody who has several limbs, but, like, otherwise appears normal, you know? This is something really good for her to be... It's a good stretch out of her comfort zone.
Yeah, definitely. It's good to be challenged. Also, she's just wrong when she sends secondhand darts. What an abject waste of time. There's nothing wrong with watching other people do activities. It's fine.
I mean, it's not a bad time, but I would just feel like I was not contributing. I like joining in. Yeah, I see Penny's point on that. I'm not a pub person either. Unless there's trivia involved, in which case I really love it. I'm just going to loop back to Simon and Baz for a second. A connection I did notice is that Simon is connecting his discomfort with words. And this is happening in a few places. So on page 221, he finally tells Baz, like, that feathery feeling, don't, like, touch me or don't, but don't, like, whisper on me. And Baz is like, ah, I can remind myself not to be gentle. And that's just a really beautiful moment. And then it is followed up by the one I mentioned earlier where, you know, on page 259, I don't know how people do this, Simon says, with his voice low and urgent. I'm much better at pushing you away than pulling you close. Are we allowed to be together all the time? Or is that too much? Just tell me if it's too much. I love that he's asking for these connections. I love these bids. I love that he's openly communicating, and especially saying don't do this, which is such a hard thing to say when you really care about the person you're with. You don't want to put any barriers up.
Yeah, it's great, because his initial instinct would have been to run away, but now he's not allowed to run away, so he has to say it because he doesn't want to experience the uncomfortable thing, which is great.
I love it, and I love that Baz is like, okay, I can do this, but then he says, I'll continue to love you kindly. I won't touch you gently, but I'll keep loving you kindly, which is also really beautiful.
Yeah.
Because he sees that Simon does need a bit of tenderness. Where I saw both envy and connection is in Neve's knowledge that the goats are connected to Watford. And I think she envies Agatha, as we spoke about. I think she envies Agatha her ignorance and her selfishness here. She does make a lot of assumptions based on this, but I think knowing that connection, it's really important to her, and she feels connected to it. She feels responsible for it, right? She's touched it. It's now her problem. But I think she does feel like she's really alone in it and that she doesn't have any support. And I think she wishes she didn't have to care. I think she envies that of Agatha. Agatha not having to care about that.
Mm. Yeah, I'd say that's fair. Like, sometimes ignorance is bliss, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's all my main points.
I have one more. Maybe it falls more into the tangential. On page 232... when they're at this meeting, Simon says, if there's one thing I can thank the mage for, it's that he never sent me out on these dog and pony shows. Most of these magicians have never seen me in person before. I mean, it is, again, the worst guy you know makes a point. like there was a lot that the mage did that was terrible. And I kind of am even suspicious of this. Do you think he kept Simon, like, sort of under his wing as, like, a... keep him close, keep him controlled? Or do you think he kept him close because he didn't want people to, like, see that they were related?
I think he just was keeping his weapon secret, right? Yeah. Secret weapons are only good if, you know, people don't know. Especially when he thinks of Simon as like a bomb, right? Like,
send him in to go off. That's a good point. I think there's something really beautiful in that Simon can connect that. That was actually good for me. I'm grateful that I didn't have to experience that and still be like, at least one thing the mage did wasn't objectively terrible. No matter what his reasons were, it was still good. But anyways, this is not me standing the mage. That guy's the worst.
No, he is absolutely the worst.
Did you have any tangential marginalia?
I have mentioned a few of them already, but you know, there's one that makes me really sad, and that's when Daphne says to Baz on page 240, "Yes, Basil, I do blame him. If there was a way for you to heal yourself, I would support you, even if the means were unorthodox." And he says, genuinely not sure whether she means the vampire thing or the gay thing. I hate this idea that you need to fix yourself. You know, even if there is something wrong, like even if you consider the vampire thing like an illness, just stop telling people to fix themselves, you know?
It's okay to just be how you are.
Well, it just assumes that there's a normal way of being, right? Like, there's this real, it's quite ableist to assume that this is the ideal model. And therefore, if you look at someone who has any kind of disability or some sort of issue and you're like, oh, if only you could heal yourself. But those people are perfectly happy.
Yeah, it's like, actually, no, I don't want to heal myself. I want the world to accommodate me.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm not the problem.
Yes, exactly. I think there's something interesting here because there's a lot about like myself that I'm perfectly happy with, but then if someone said, hey, if you never had depression again, I'm like, yes, where is that? I would take that red pill. Like, if I could never wake up feeling that void 100%. So I kind of wonder if that's something that is just a discrepancy between Daphne viewing how Baz feels about himself versus how Baz actually feels about himself. I don't know if that makes sense. So I think a lot of the times parents have different expectations for their kids than they do.
Yeah. And also when she says to him, you know, you've always met your parents' expectations, and he's like, I think we both know that's not true, because it's this real trivializing. She's taking the fact that she doesn't have magic and he does have magic, like it compensates for everything else that he is marginalized for, and it's not a one in, one out, my pain is bigger than yours situation, right?
Yeah, and it also ignores all of the very real struggles he's had as, like, going to school as a teenaged vampire, pardon me, and, like, being gay when your dad keeps trying to marry you off to random other magical women. Like, there's a lot there. There's a lot going on. Although I do think Malcolm's coming around. He just doesn't know how to say it. I have a feeling that he's like, okay, you know?
I also agree. I'm quite sympathetic to Malcolm. I think
he's just old.
He just doesn't have the words either. Like, they're not a family that communicates. That's part of the problem. I think there's a lot of projection from Baz on what he thinks his father thinks.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, sort of politeness that obscures real communication.
Yeah.
And a lot of, your mother thinks, or I bet your father would be okay with. And it's like, you can just say it, guys. Just say it. It's okay.
Yeah, just come out and say it. Absolutely.
Yes.
I really agree with Lady Ruth when she says on page 258, anything worth believing in should stand up to some interrogation. Yes. I'm like, yes. If you truly believe in something, you shouldn't get angry when people question it, because you should be able to explain it. If you can't, then there's something wrong with the concept.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that this gets perverted a lot in online circles and discourse, especially when it's people seedlining you, just baiting you to keep going because they don't have any stakes in it. But yeah, I do find that I love that her interrogation is what caused Jamie to be like, no, I can't deal with this, because he needed to believe it. He needs to believe that this is something that he can be cured, right?
And it's the same with Daphne. Like, she wants to believe. Yeah. That's why it holds, because people want to believe.
Absolutely. And it's so much harder to accept yourself and love yourself than try and fix yourself. But I love Lady Ruth. She's just great. I love that she feeds them more cake. I love that she puts her foot in her mouth about why would anybody call their mother? Aww. And they're like, we're both looking so super motherless right now. And she's like, boys, I'm sorry. I've had my foot in my mouth my whole life. And I was like, I'm with you, Lady Ruth. This is me. I am also foot in the mouth all the time. I just think she's lovely. And I love how passionate she is and how much she cares. She's the best.
Yeah. Did you have any more tangential?
I love Penny responding that she was not cold calling a demon. That made me laugh.
Yeah, great.
And I loved the story of the goats. The story goes the same herd has been watching over Watford as long as it has existed. If they ever choose to leave, it would mean the school is truly lost. The goats would take all of their protection with them. So I love that Niamh is like taking advantage of everybody indulging her, because she believes in this old wives' tale, as she puts it. But she's going to take care of the goats whether or not the protection is real. But she thinks it is real, and she's very worried about that. And I love that she brings Agatha in. So that just makes me a little happier. So I think that was it for my tangential. Did you have an in-depth marginalia?
I did. So mine is on page 234, and it is the section where Smith Richards is conning everyone and doing his little show, talking to them just before he heals his subject of the evening, and he says, "Remember, they're used to you as you are. They're used to feeling more powerful than you. You're challenging the world as they know it, and they don't like it. They don't like it, friends." So I think this is envy, because, like we've discussed this whole episode, really, it really plays into this idea that you can you want something someone else has, in this case, power. Yeah. You know, there's something that other people hold. You don't have it, and you're envious of that. And also expectation, I think, because it assumes a status quo that there is a certain way to be in the world and you're expected to behave a certain way. And people buy into that. So that's really what this plays on.
Yeah.
But he's not wrong. Because like all good charlatans, he's really building on a kernel of truth, a real truth of the universe. Because like it really reminded me of that saying, when you're accustomed to privilege, equality feels like oppression.
Yes.
I've been having lots of conversations about like the writer's strike and things, and how we really have to... People in power don't willingly give up power, right? Yeah. So when you are faced with this situation where you are in a minority, or that you are being put upon in some way, you can't just wait for those people to dole out something to you from the goodness of their hearts.
Yeah.
And I think about this, I think it was on Twitter or Tumblr, I saw people talking about this as well, how people sit around and judge liberal governments particularly for not making these sweeping changes. But nowhere in history have sweeping changes come from a government. They start from grassroots movements. They come from strikes and from riots and from social justice movements. Like, we don't have an 8-hour workday because the government one day decided that they were going to legislate for it. There was unions who got us that, right? And so now we sit around and we go, oh, if only we had a 4-hour workday. Why can't the government give us a 4-hour workday? If we want that, there's only one way to get it.
Make noise about it.
Got to join a union. Got to strike. Like, these are the things you have to do. You have to stand up for the causes that you believe in if you really want to see change in the world, because people in power do not give that power away lightly. That's how they continue to get power. That's how they continue to get money. So going forward, I just think it's a reminder for us all to get involved in the movements that matter, to fight for change at a grassroots level, because that's how you make people listen and that's how you make change. You can't just sit around and wish the world was better. You have to go in and make it better.
Absolutely.
So yeah, just a reminder for all of us.
I love that. And it's so true. If you're working and your workplace or your profession has a union, find out, join the union. It's worth it. I have so many friends who were like conservative and then joined professions like nursing, and they were like, oh, the union has saved me. And they had never thought about it before. But having your rights protected in the workplace when you're so easily taken advantage of is such a good thing. So yes, find your union. Love your unions.
Absolutely. What was your in-depth marginalia?
Mine is on page 212. And it is, again, the Niamh and Agatha conversation. And this is where Niamh really gets shirty with Agatha. And she says, "Maybe it doesn't matter to you whether Watford falls, but it's the heart of who we are as magicians. It's our only institution, the only thing we've managed to get done and make work." So I think the way it relates to the theme is that Niamh is trying to explain that the goats are connected to Watford. She believes this. She's trying to make it make sense for Agatha. And she's also trying to say that, like, whether it's a myth or a legend or whatever, it's still important. And she's frustrated that Agatha doesn't believe in the connection. And as I said before, I think she envies the fact that Agatha doesn't have to care, because she can't help but care. But it still frustrates her when it's someone that she thinks should know better. Like, I think that her expectation is that Agatha should know better and is capable of caring. So at the moment I'm reading The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, and Gilbert has a lot of envy about the affection of Mrs. Graham. Like, he is certain that he'll never get it, but then he does get it, but then he's like these very concerned about what's happening with it. And I don't want to spoil it, even though it's a really old book, for anybody who reads it. They should read it. It's a cracking book. But this envy that he has to be in her good graces, to be someone that she would look at, is something that really drives him kind of in a good way to be a better person, but also kind of drives him to do some not so great things. So it's really interesting. I just kept thinking about, like, oh, like Gilbert and Helen have their own sort of envy of each other just based on the circumstances of their lives. So it's interesting to see when that envy becomes jealousy. And it's also interesting to see how it starts out as a yearning, right? Like, I love to think about yearning as a type of envy. Wanting to be with someone you think you can't be with is a really powerful feeling. And I think there's some envy in, like, wanting to be able to let go of things you care about that Neve is also experiencing. Like, she wishes she didn't have to care so much, but she also knows that it is her job to care. So I think it's worth remembering that envy can give us goals. It can give us some ambition. It can also point us in a direction that might be worth examining. But, like, I would think maybe to be careful with that. Like, don't channel it into everything. But it can also be a good way of, like, reframing or looking at or examining ourselves.
I never thought of reframing envy, but you've really opened my eyes to that throughout this podcast. So I really enjoy that. Thank you for that.
Isn't the joke about being bi as a girl, not knowing if you want to date someone or be someone? Like,
it's when I look at Cate Blanchett, I'm like, do I want to be her? Or
Right?
Am I just really into her?
I mean, who isn't? I think if you've got a pulse and two working eyeballs, you're into Cate Blanchett.
She's so glorious. She's
amazing. Who would you like to spotlight this week?
I am going to spotlight our girl, Penny, because I think she just really wants for once to feel like she's in control of something or she has the right info. And she has been on the back foot for so long now. I just really feel for her. She keeps losing at the moment. And I think she just wants to win. And that's okay. I really want that for her as well. Like, it's good for her to learn and to, like, check her hubris. But I feel like this hit from Shep was unnecessary and quite, I feel for her. I just feel for her.
Aww. Agreed.
Who would you like to spotlight?
I would like to spotlight Daphne. I think she needs a hug and a reality check. And I know that the hug would be much easier to give her because she doesn't want to rejoin reality. She doesn't want to know what's happened. And I respect that, but also I'm frustrated because I know what it's like to really, really want something, but this isn't going to work out for her, and it just makes my heart so sad.
Yeah.
Do you have any homework for our readers this week?
I don't have any homework, but I will say that if you can, to watch the football, because I think this episode might be out before, maybe not. No, it's the final this weekend. It is. Okay, so never mind. You're going to miss it by the time this gets published, but it's fine.
We hope watch that the you replays. Watch the
replays. Watch the replays of the Matilda game. Yeah,
100%.
What about you? What's your homework?
I think everyone should read The Tenant of Wildfell Hall by Anne Bronte. She's the not romantic Bronte sister, so she's writing in the more realistic style. And a lot of people call this a really seminal feminist text because it's about a woman who leaves her alcoholic husband, which is fantastic. You don't see books that were written in the mid-1800s that talk about this. But we love and stan our Helen Huntington, so... also, I've been reading the Tommy and Tuppence Mysteries, which is just pure Agatha Christie fun. Highly recommend. I love their dynamic.
Nice. Cool.
Yeah. So next week, we'll be reading chapters 38 through 46 through the theme of grief, because this week hasn't been hard enough.
Grim.
We're going to make it even worse. Can't wait.
Woo. All right. Well, thank you so much. Always a delight to see you.
And thanks for putting up with my raspy post-soccer game voice.
Oh, that's all good. So much yelling. Cheer them on. Well deserved.
Exactly.
All right. I'll see you next week.
All right. See you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us today. Marginalia Pod is written, edited, and produced by us, Jen D and Jen V. We'd love to hear from you. Send an email to hello@marginaliapod.com, check out our Instagram, or maybe dash off a quick review. You can also subscribe so you never miss an episode. Our music is by Scott Buckley, and the logo artwork is by Laura Cato. You can find detailed show notes for each episode and much more at our website www.marginaliapod.com. Special thanks to all the people in our various communities whose love and care sustains us. Without your support, we would be very sad little critters. We appreciate you. And to you, our wonderful listeners, thanks again for being here. We love spending this time with you.